the beauty about bow hunting and is there. Like, you can see his wet nose. You can see his eyelashes blinking.
Yeah.
You know, they scratch their ear. All those things that, to me, it's just, you're in their world.
You are, totally.
And, you know, and it's a different experience. Way different than people that have hunted with a rifle for years, like my trapline partner. And I've got some good friends that are wildlife photographers, but they've got the 2,000-millimeter lens that can suck them right up.
Yeah.
Well, if you get within 10 yards of that animal and they don't know you're there, it's a special feeling. To me, it's a very special feeling.
Absolutely. Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to Your Forest. I'm Matthew Kristoff. And today I had an awesome conversation with a gentleman, Brent Watson. And he is the president of the Alberta Bowhunters Association, which is an organization that was formed, I think he said, in the 80s. I can't remember exactly, but it has been advocating for hunters' rights and bowhunters' rights for a long time. And they're responsible for a lot of the things that we're allowed to do today in the hunting community, like the bow zone around Edmonton and Calgary, archery seasons, lots of other stuff too. And they've just been advocating for conservation and you know, sustainable bow hunting for a long time. And they're a great, great organization. He's a super thoughtful dude. He came on, we talked very in depth about what hunting means to him, why it's important to society. We really got into the emotional aspect of it, like the emotional journey of hunting through being unsuccessful to finally being successful to the shot, to the, you know, the whole experience. It was an awesome conversation. And I really, really appreciate Brent coming on to talk about this kind of stuff. Cause it's a hard conversation to have. Cause you're really kind of showing, you know, your colors when it comes to the emotions you're going through and the thoughts that you're having, and just very, very thoughtful dude. So I really want to talk about hunting from that aspect, from not an aspect of just acquiring meat, but also of how it makes you a better person and how it makes you more compassionate and thoughtful. And it might sound hokey dokey. A lot of you might be laughing. I don't know, but it was just awesome. I loved it. And I think you guys will like it too. And yeah, I guess without any further ado, here's Brent and I. I wanted to ask you about how long have you been hunting, and when did you start bow hunting, and how did you get into this world?
Yeah, I grew up rural community, outdoors from the time we were little, mm-hmm. eating dirt in the garden and shooting bows and arrows out of Carrigana sticks. And
nice.
On the uncle's farms and playing in the creek, and always had a fascination or like nature and wildlife. And, mm-hmm. and then just my dad didn't hunt. Few of the uncles hunted. But that was more just on the farm, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't the critters around back then, you know, and they'd get the odd thing and throw it in the freezer. But just, I guess, I just like nature.
Right.
And then I, my first paycheck I ever got, I bought a spotting scope and a tripod.
Nice.
And, you know, watching ducks and geese on sloughs and all that stuff. And then my next paycheck, I bought a rifle.
Nice.
And then it just progressed from there.
And this is, you're still in your teens at this point, or?
Yeah, I would have been working forestry. Summers would be 16, 17.
Okay. Yeah. So just grew up with it. This was part of you just, from the beginning. Yeah.
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 And then a good friend of mine, kind of mentioned archery, bow hunting. And I always kind of wanted to, but you know, I was just a rifle hunter and that was good enough at the time. And then, mm-hmm. so I traded in a really nice gun for a bow and then eventually it wasn't long after I dropped the rifle altogether.
Oh, really?
And I don't know. I just liked the new challenge, the closeness with your critters.
Oh.
You know, you're right there with them, and so many things can go wrong, but when it goes right, it's pretty satisfying. And then, you know, over the years, and then, you know, I got into traditional archery because I wanted to, you know, it was just a progression.
Totally, yeah.
And then for the last, I don't know, it's got to be 15 or... It's got to be 15 at least. That's all I've hunted with is traditional gear.
Nice.
Yeah.
And, that's a whole nother level.
Yeah. It's a lot of, you know, it's a lot, you know, the difficulty, the degree of difficulty goes way up.
Yeah.
But when it does happen, it's pretty satisfying, you know.
And, yeah.
And, you know, it's just a different challenge.
Right. You well, know, I know so, like the one good way I always, I can't remember who told me this or I heard it on a podcast or something. Someone said that where the rifle hunt ends is where the bow hunt begins.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's, I think that's an awesome way to describe that situation. Yeah. Right. Cause I mean, it's like you're saying, when you see an animal with a rifle, you go, oh, there it is. And it's done. Right. Yeah. And not that that's not exciting. And like I mostly rifle hunt, right. Yeah. I've only the last couple of years I started bow hunting, but
yeah.
I imagine with the going from a compound, like modern day bow to a traditional bow is probably another whole level of another that,
whole
right?
level. It's a whole, yeah. It's a whole bunch of degrees more difficult than,
yeah.
But it is, I don't know if it'd be satisfying. It's not for everybody because not everybody's got the time I got now that I'm retired and stuff too. And it does take, and a lot of people have to get in their mind when they go from say a rifle to a compound to a recurve, you have to have in your mindset that degree of difficulty is going to cost you
big time.
You know, if I'd had my compound, I could have got that thing, or if I'd had my gun, I would have got them. But you have to get it in your head that not all the time it's going to work. And you got to be mentally ready for those disappointments.
Big time.
And I know guys that have got completely out of traditional archery because it costs them
too much.
If I'd had my compound, I'd have got them.
Well, it gets to a point where you're in a meat crisis, you know.
Like for sure.
Freezer's empty. Like this is how you feed your family mainly for your own protein. And it's like I was in that situation this year where I still bow hunted the whole time and I was unlucky. But that's the thing though. Even though I didn't manage to harvest anything, the amount of things that I learned and the amount of experiences I had that I wouldn't have had with the rifle was phenomenal. Oh, right, like it's just you're just so much closer, more just everything's more intense, right? It's awesome. But
my trap line partner, well, he's almost 80 now, and he guided for moose for years, and he was a moose hunter. And then I you know, when we hunt moose with a bow and take video, and bulls are coming into like 5 and 10 yards rocking their head and doing all that stuff, he'd never seen that.
Yeah.
Because he said they don't get close enough to do that. They step out and we shoot them.
God, it's intimidating when you have a 1,000-pound animal 10 feet away with it's all rocked up and ready to fight, right? Like it's just like, ooh.
Yeah. And you know, in all the years he's hunted, and you know, he's shot 51 moose in his lifetime.
Yeah.
And he's never had the experience of a bull rocking his head and coming in close, because he said we didn't let them.
And it's a whole other appreciation for the animal, right?
Yeah.
Like that's the thing. Like I think, like you just get that much closer. You really experience them. You really connect with that animal in a crazy way that you can't with a rifle. But I was thinking this year though, I've been unlucky for a couple years. I've gotten some whitetail with the bow the last 2 years, but I haven't been fortunate enough to get an elk or a moose. And the freezer's getting pretty empty, and I think next year elk season is going to be a rifle season.
Well, for sure. You know, guys, you got to have kind of your priorities. And geez, I like to eat.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I know. I've told guys, you know, hunting with a recurve, the freezer doesn't get as full, and your taxidermist bill is pretty low.
Oh, and you got to spend so much time. I think that's the thing that people with rifle hunting, you already have to spend so much time to be successful.
Yeah.
And then bow hunting is tenfold that to try and get close, and traditional hunting I'm sure is even past that.
It's right? Another big step.
Yeah, because it's just wild. Yeah. So I guess I want to kind of get into, like I was telling you before, I want to kind of get into the why you hunt, like really like the emotional aspect of it and like what it brings to your life, like how you think that it brings your, like makes your life better and kind of enhances your quality of life. Cause I think that's something that people don't hear a lot of, the yeah. people that are uninitiated, they don't hunt or whatever. Right. They just kind of see, they either see hunting and they think it's cruel and stupid and unnecessary, yeah. or they have done some research and they understand the ethics behind it and they're on board, but they also still don't get it.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, just from your perspective, like what is it, what has it done for you?
Well, I think, you know, in, you know, you're aware of the social media and the changes in public perception of all kinds of things in yeah. the last year, 5 years, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about it a bit yesterday at this, our stakeholder meetings mm-hmm. we have with government and the word trophy and the word sport, mm-hmm. When it comes, you know, to define hunting. And, you know, and I said, and I still believe it, and that it's not a sport. It's not like hockey. It's not like baseball.
No.
It's to me, a trophy is when you go hunting and you get something, that's a trophy. It's an accomplishment in some degree, mm-hmm. whether it has no horns or big horns or whatever.
Yeah.
I kind of call myself a selective harvester, because mm-hmm. some days I'll let that critter walk, hoping maybe to get something bigger, either bigger in body to eat, mm-hmm. or maybe bigger antlers. Or
yeah.
You know, and at the size of the antlers, that goes right back to the caveman days when they painted pictures on caves of something with big horns. Mm-hmm. They're more mature, they're smarter, they're harder to get, and it was an accomplishment over shooting a yearling kind of thing. So there's all kinds of challenges there, and you feel, you know, maybe it's a bigger accomplishment to get something, you know, that's bigger, bigger bodied, bigger horned.
Right. Well, you don't want the experience to end, is the way I like to put it, right? Like it's, yeah. Hunting is not just the act of going out and killing something. And I want to get to that later, the difference between hunting and killing, right? Yeah. And it's, because that's not what it is. It's not, like, at least for
that's
me.
That's the final chapter.
That's the end, yeah.
Yeah, that's the end of the book, more or less. But there's a whole lot leading up to it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, and that's the thing, right? There's a difference between I hunt because I enjoy the hunt. I like mm-hmm. interacting, and I like seeing the animals, and I like knowing what they're up to and learning about them and being a part of that and connecting with nature in that way. And then in the end of it, yeah, there's a meat outcome in the end, right?
Yeah.
But also, for people, for example, like I have antlers in my house, right? And but for people that come in and they look at them and at the antlers and they go, oh, that's disgusting, right? And I'm like, well, what would you rather I do? Just throw it out? Are we pretending that they're not beautiful? Like, I was going to shoot that animal anyways. Are we pretending yeah. that it's not a gorgeous piece of nature that like we're exactly. representing here, right? It's no difference than having a beautiful piece of wood in your house or whatever. And it's yeah. just, it's a part of the animal that you're appreciating.
Yeah.
And it's not like you're going out and you're shooting this animal, to cutting the horns off and leaving it. That's poaching, and that's super screwed up and messed up and yeah. egotistical, and nobody is arguing for that.
No, exactly.
Right? So it's...
And yeah. it's just a reminder, like I've got lots of mounts and, you know, horns and I've got deer feet made into hooks to hang my coat on. And it's all a reminder of that experience with that animal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all leading up to it, the days and the weeks of scouting or putting up tree stands or trying to, you know, get something. And then when you do get it and when you look at it, it's no different than when I take a piece of steak out of the freezer to cook that night. You remember that animal, how you got it, how hard it was to pack it out, mm-hmm. all that stuff. It all comes back.
Big time.
And I think hunting, like to me, we talked about it yesterday and there was a presentation and it was about a new software that the government is using, kind of, it was private developer put together a software for population dynamics and all the things you can do and
gotcha.
And stuff. And he did a presentation and he had the resident sport harvest in one of his PowerPoints. Mm-hmm. All these other things were involved. Resident sport harvest. So I said, I don't like that word sport, because to me it's not sport.
It's not a game.
No.
It's like the best way I can describe it is it's a lifestyle. Like it's something that it honestly it's addictive in a way. Like it consumes your thought and you just love it's the experience, right? It's it's not the kill itself. It's the experience that is so addictive, right? Yeah. And Yeah, the word sport is just so disingenuous.
And demeaning to me. Because super demeaning, I said, hunting to me, it's part of my culture. Mm-hmm. It's part of my heritage.
Yep.
It's part of my traditions.
Yeah.
And it's to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we got to get the message out is, it's, and for generations, mm-hmm. it's not because of a certain race or a certain religion or any of that stuff. It's part of their culture going back 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. Well, my culture goes back just as far, maybe not on this continent, but my ancestors were hunters. So it's part of my tradition, and it's part of my culture, it's part of my everyday life.
Yeah.
So that, to me, it's not a sport at all.
No.
And
it's how you feed your family, right? It's the, it's like, personally, I take a lot of stock in being able to have like wild, super healthy, unadulterated, you know what I mean, meat in my freezer organic that I can feed my family. It's organic. It's the healthiest thing you can get out there.
Yeah.
And it's, and like you were saying before, like we skipped over it a little fast, but talking about like the idea of taking out just a steak from the, like a beef steak from the freezer, right?
Yeah.
To that person, it's just meat.
There's no connection.
There's no connection. And I promise you that if they might not even pay full attention to that meat and screw it up and end up throwing it out because they messed it up the cooking process. Whereas no hunter would ever do that because there's such a connection to that meat. You mm-hmm. care so much about it. You take good care of it. You don't throw it out. Even if you burnt it, you're still going to eat it because you feel guilty for not having like totally used it, right? Like it's one of those, I can't overstate the connection thing, right? Like
And I think that's what a lot of people just don't get,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they,
unless you've done it, you can't really.
Yeah. And a lot of people say they're connected with nature. Well, they're not. They go for a drive in the country and they see a deer and they figure they're connected to nature. Mm-hmm. I guess in a way they kind of are, mm-hmm. but really hunters are so much more connected.
Oh,
they're part of it. They're holding hands with nature. Their monies go to preserving nature. Even if we can't hunt something, we're spending money to preserve nature.
Yeah.
And when we do hunt stuff, that money is going to make sure that that part of nature is going to be there for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I got a problem with some people that, you know, they got all these concepts and ideas about what nature should be and how it should work. Well, mm-hmm. you don't have a vested interest.
Mm-hmm.
You get on a keyboard, or you get on a, you know, you pound your drum.
Yeah.
But start putting out some money. Start seeing what it's all about, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, Africa is a prime example with, you know, the hunting industry over there and all the flack it's taking. And, you know, I pay attention to that because it's got ripple effects over here. And, you know, there's huge dollars that hunters spend. And I don't have those huge dollars to go spend it. But good on those that do, because that's supporting nature over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of those countries, you know, they've bowed to international pressure and they've eliminated hunting or hunting of some species.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? Them things are in big trouble because there's no monies for anti-poaching and all the rest of it. And so
Africa's a whole nother issue. Oh. Like it's, I can't even, I know the arguments and I, it's just, it's, there's so much with that one that it's like, yeah, it's beyond me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we see the same kind of things here.
For sure.
Maybe not to the degree yet,
mm-hmm.
but there's going to be political decisions, or have been, about hunting issues. And it's totally based on emotion and not science. And it's mm-hmm. got big effects. And, you know, that's where I guess, you know, maybe on another tangent is the involvement of hunters in the political arena. Being more active on social media, defending what we do, and we just need more people to
mm-hmm.
get in the face of politicians and pound our drum,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's kind of a bit of a sore spot with me. We just don't have the people that
mm-hmm.
defend what they do.
Yeah. There's not, there's a few voices like the Alberta Bowhunters Association, right? You guys yourselves and the Alberta Conservation Association and the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Yeah, there's a bunch of group, you know, there's all of us stakeholders. And you know, we go to meetings and, you know, we do our thing and as associations, but it's It's so much more powerful if 1,000 individuals wrote a letter.
Big time.
Than if the Alberta bow hunters wrote a letter.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, because the politicians know what the Alberta bow hunters are going to say or what the Alberta Fish and Game are going to say. They know what we're going to say.
Yeah.
But if they got 1,000 letters from just Joe Public,
that's
powerful.
Yeah.
100 letters.
Yeah. Yeah, because like one letter, it has to translate into how many other people that haven't written a letter, right? So they have to have that thought in mind, I'm sure.
Yeah.
No, it's, yeah, and just like I don't know. There's just this huge misconception, right? That hunters are just these mindless oafs going around blasting stuff for fun.
Yeah,
right?
FUD.
Getting your jollies out of killing something.
Yeah.
And that is just not it. That's so far from the truth. It hurts, right? Like it's offensive when you hear people think that way. Cause I'm like, listen, man, like we've got way more invested in this than you ever could.
Oh,
right. And I honestly think that being a hunter makes you a more considerate, more thoughtful, more well-rounded person in the end, really. Cause it just, you have a connection with life and death and with the natural world in a way that, even if you're, say you're someone who spends just as much time hiking as you and I do hunting, you're not, no matter how much you hike, you're not going to have the connection that we have. Cause you're not, if like the only person that might would be maybe like a wildlife photographer, they might have a similar connection because they're getting up close and they're trying to sneak up to them and they're watching them and observing their feeding process and their birthing process and their, all that kind of stuff. Right. They might have a similar connection, but if you're just a person who's observing and not interacting, there's no way you can appreciate it the way that someone who's interacting does, right?
No.
And it's hard to get that message across, right?
Yeah.
It just makes you a more thoughtful person, right? Like it just brings that forethought about how your actions affect other beings, right? Like other animals and that kind of stuff. And it's just, I think it's important to exist in society, right? Like not everybody can hunt. That's not really possible. But also, the more people that do it, I think the better off society is, really.
Well, yeah, I think so. Because they have a more vested interest in nature and what happens to it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if something happens and moose are in trouble, the guy driving around just to see a moose, I didn't see a moose today. I'm kind of mad. And then the person driving around to get a picture of a moose, Jesus, he's got a vested interest. He'd like to see moose. Well, there's no moose, so I can't take a picture. Ah, God, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, as a hunter, if there's no moose out there, I don't eat.
Yeah.
Like, I prefer to hunt moose. Mm-hmm. There's no moose out there. So what do we do?
Yeah.
Well, geez, we need to, there's different conservation management strategies that we're invested in and we're part of and cut the tags back and do all these things. And we're involved in that.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the other non-consumptive users shrug their shoulders and walk away.
Yeah.
You know, and hunters spend a pile of money and, there's economic benefits to hunting outside of.
Well, huge. I saw a thing today. Was it Massachusetts? Or I can't remember. One of the states posted, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers posted a thing online saying that the amount of money that went in directly into the economy just from hunting, just hunting alone, was like $5.8 billion last year, just into that one state, right? Yeah. Like there's a huge amount of economic benefit towards it as well. It's not just a consumption thing or whatever, right? So it's... Yeah,
lots of spinoffs.
Yeah.
It's a huge, huge economic driver in a lot of places.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, and, you know, the kind of the first line defenders of any species is hunters.
Yeah.
Has been for centuries. Theodore Roosevelt started the Boone and Crockett Club, and that was all about conservation. We got to stop this unlimited stuff. We got to put seasons. We got to, and that's going back a couple hundred years.
Well, because they have a vested interest, right? They're not interested in seeing these animals not exist anymore, right? And they're the first line of realization that there is a problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because we're the first ones, always have been. If something is in trouble, we're the first ones to throw our hands up and say, geez, we got to stop.
Yeah.
We got to change.
All the biggest names in conservation have been hunters, right?
I remember
Aldo Leopold,
30 years ago around Grand Prairie in our Fish and Game Club.
Yeah.
We could see over the course of a few years. It was a general moose season. And with the population growth up there, the increase in access, moose were population was going down.
Yeah.
Guys that typically are good moose hunters weren't getting moose. The size of the carcasses coming into, we had meat records from the butcher shops up there that, you know, 5 years ago, an average moose was 600 pounds. Now it's 400 pounds.
Really?
This age class is smaller. We're trimming off. We, you know, we have our awards nights and we're not getting any big bull moose in entered anymore. You know, I'm a measurer for Polk and Young and Boone and Crockett, and there's no moose to measure. Whereas 5 years ago, we were scoring big bulls.
When you want those, you want the whole age class to be out there, right? You want those like that, those big bulls, and you want, because like, they have an interaction with nature that the small ones can't have, right? Oh,
exactly. So when you lose, so all the indicators were that we don't have the moose we used to have.
Yeah.
And so we started lobbying with the biologists and fish and game conventions and the government to put moose on a draw.
Yeah.
Because they can't sustain this pressure.
Yeah.
And it took about four years and moose went on a draw, and they've been on a draw ever since, and the draw's expanded.
Yep.
So that's a sign, like the person that was driving around out there just to take a picture of moose, he didn't lobby to do anything. And so it was hunters that stepped up and said, geez, we got to preserve these moose.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Like, it means I can't go hunting a moose every year, but that don't matter.
Right.
We want moose on the landscape.
I
want
to be able to do that from now and again, right? Like, I remember even in my lifetime when I first started hunting, we could get I could draw a moose tag in 350 south of Slave Lake every 2 years, priority two. And now I think it's an 8 or 9. So it takes 8 or 9 years to get that tag. And so that speaks volumes about the population levels, but it also speaks volumes about the hunting community and how much they're willing to, you know, give up to try and make sure that these values exist in perpetuity, right?
Yeah.
Like the one of the saddest things I could imagine would be that my children and my grandchildren wouldn't be able to have the same experiences I had.
Yeah.
Right. And exactly. No, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so we're, you know, as far as hunters go, we're heavily, heavily involved with, you know, stakeholder and I guess senior fish and wildlife personnel.
Right. The Alberta Bowhunters Association, or just hunters, you mean? Yeah.
And hunters in general.
Right.
You know, it'd be about 11 years ago, the government of the day, it was Ed Stelmach, actually, more transparency, more consultation with the public, and which really kind of opened the door. Before, it was kind of really hard to get in to see the decision makers.
Yeah.
You know, the bureaucratic layer of government, where, you know, those places, that's where the decisions are made.
Yeah.
A lot of them. So it was really hard. And then, you know, there was a change. We need more transparency and all that. So they started, you know, they invited stakeholders to the table, and that's continued on. And it's an extremely valuable process. Every stakeholder, we got the Alberta bow hunters, we got our little concerns, and, you know, the Alberta Outfitters Society, they have their concerns, and the Alberta Fish and Game and the Naturalist Society and the beef producers and the municipalities, and we all got concerns about wildlife.
Yeah.
And so we all meet at least twice a year, and we go over issues and then regulation change. What would you like to see change in the regulations? Developing policy for fish and wildlife. How do we address this issue?
Yeah.
Let's develop a policy with stakeholder input.
Yeah.
Because you guys are kind of the boots on the ground a lot of times, and you're connected to local things and provincial things. And
yeah.
So it's been an extremely, extremely valuable process. The biggest hurdle is to get the political end of it to keep up to speed.
Right.
Because there's all kinds of politics that gets played, and and, you know, there's decisions that'll happen like God in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And then there's things that everybody agrees on and moves forward and gets to a certain door.
Yeah.
And it sits there
for
2 years or maybe never even happens.
Like it's,
so, you know, there's rewards and there's frustrations, but it, you know, so, you know, as consumptive users and hunter interest groups, we're at the tables we need to be at now
for sure.
The last, you know, 10 years. So,
yeah.
So we can get issues that, you know, bow hunters might have, and we can take it and debate it and discuss it with all the stakeholders and the senior government staff and develop maybe a reg change that goes through the system. Some make it, some don't, you know, some take longer than others.
Yeah.
And then there's developing policy.
Yeah.
You know, for fish and wildlife, how do we address this going forward?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's extremely valuable. And,
big time.
So how
did you get involved with the ABA originally?
When?
Because you've been there a long time, right?
Yeah, so I, you know, even going back to, God, in the early 80s, I always, like with the local fish and game club, always felt you had to give something back.
Yeah.
So the club was just getting resurrected, and a couple of guys, like, you know, just... new, not real good, but so they were getting involved. So I went to the one meeting, and then of course, you know, there's 10 of you there, and
yeah.
So okay, I'll do membership, and
yeah,
and then it kind of started like that, and then I was president a bunch of years, and
you're president now too, aren't you?
Of the Fish and Game Club back then, and then
oh,
and then it got into bow hunting, and then. You know, the archery club in Grand Prairie was just getting going, and got involved in that. And then there was this Alberta Bow Hunters Association, and they had a banquet in Edmonton. So, God, so a couple of us come down there, and it was just, and that kind of changed it. It, you know, you just see all of these guys that, and girls too, mm-hmm. not so many back then, but piles now. And
it's awesome.
And it's all bow hunters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk to them, you hear their stories, you hear all this stuff, and the things that are going, you go to some of the meetings, and yeah. This is the things we're lobbying for and all that stuff. So,
and you guys have managed to do a lot for the province, for hunters in general and bow hunters specifically too, right? Like you guys have pulled off a lot of lobbying, a lot of...
Yeah, it's been... I started in the executive, it'd be 20 years ago. And then I was regulations guy for a few years. Mm-hmm. And then... been president for, this will be my 14th year.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so, you know, you go to these
no
meetings.
No term limits over there, eh?
No. No, yeah, you kind of, yeah, when you go on the ground, you're done. But it's been, you know, it's been good. You know, we cleaned up a lot of stuff internally with, you know, our constitution, you know, all of those kind of things. We kind of got it all up to speed.
Yeah. Yep.
And it, so the ball is just nicely rolling down the road. It doesn't take much to keep it going. Mm. And then, you know, finding out what bow hunting issues are and hunting issues too. Like we're not just, you know, pounding the drum for bow hunting. There's a lot of general hunting issues we get involved in.
Big time.
You know, so, and that's in concert with other user groups too. They're pounding the same drum.
Yeah.
You know, so then collectively we can go to government, whether it's the Alberta Parks Division or Fish and Wildlife or agriculture, mm-hmm. you know, and voice our concerns.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of kudos back in the day for the government to say, we'd like you stakeholders at the table on a consistent basis. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we've had these advisory group meetings for 11 years. And then there's different committees we sit on and, you know, research all this stuff, bring it back to the general group. Yeah. And I've found it's been extremely good because all the players are there. You can talk face to face. It's not, you know... Facebook stuff. That,
it's not a debate. It's, yeah. It's not.
Yeah, your, and you can actually hear kind of what they say, and you can argue back and forth and, you know, your point and our point, and no, you're wrong, and this is why, and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, I think it's been really, really beneficial.
Yeah, it's important to have all those voices together, right?
Oh, like, big time.
It's one of the most detrimental things you can do is just put yourself in an echo chamber where it's you and a bunch of people you agree with, yet talking to each other, and I agree. Yeah. And you build yourself up to this level where you have so much confidence in something that you haven't really looked at objectively, right?
Yeah, you got tunnel vision. And yeah. You just...
So when you have those people going like, well, I don't agree because of this, this, and this, it forces you to further your argument and to further understand why you're doing something, right? So it's important to make sure that even the voices you don't agree with are at the table. So that you, and you may come to a realization one day about something that you're arguing and go, oh, wait, I never thought about it that way. Yeah. And it And, you know, it furthers you as a human being and everything, right? So
especially with the way things are changing so much.
Oh, like, yeah.
It's incredible. And, you know, back in the day, there was hunters and fishermen. That's who met with Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah.
You know, trappers and hunters and fishermen. That's who met with Fish and Wildlife. Yeah. Well, that's changed. There's municipalities have concerns about wildlife.
Yeah.
You know, the beef producers, there's a whole gamut of people that have an interest in wildlife. We're just not the only ones anymore.
Yeah.
And then there's the social acceptance of wildlife, you know, and how hunters play a role in that. You know, we got too many deer living in Calgary. Well, what do? Hunters are a mechanism to try and, you know, and there's other problems with that, with access and stuff. But yeah,
that's a real thing though, that people will poo poo because they go, oh, that's just an excuse for you to kill animals. And it's like, no guys, like if this is literally causing millions of dollars in vehicle damage and actual human death or whatever, crop damage and all kinds of different things, then you're, that's an actual economic problem. And it's a real life problem that's measured, that is easily taken care of without detrimenting that population. Yeah. Right. It's not like harvesting is done, or hunting harvesting is done to the point where, you know what I mean? It's not just willy nilly. Like you said, we've got draws, we have everything's measured out and we know exactly how many we can take sustainably. And so it's, it's one of those ones that people go, oh, that's just an excuse. And you go, well, no, not if it is in your backyard and it is causing problems, right?
Like, yeah, and a lot of people, and I have friends in Fish and Wildlife, and I've got relatives that, you know, there's one or two deer, and that's kind of neat. And, you know, they're nibbling my garden. That's not a big deal.
They're going to be there, and that's great.
Yeah. And then there's four or five, and geez, they're kind of a problem. They're, you know, I throw rocks at them or BB gun, or, and then there's eight or nine in my garden, kill them all.
Yeah.
So people, even the people that don't like hunters and they like the wildlife, it gets to a point where they want the wildlife out of there.
It's inconvenience and it's dangerous. Like and this is a super controversial subject, but even like the grizzly bear hunt in northern BC, right? Like, I mean, it's been a year and you can go online now and you can find interactions with and interviews from people in BC, in northern BC, where they're having interactions with grizzly bears that they have never even dreamed of in their entire time living there.
Yeah.
The grizzly bears are getting so bold because there's no pressure and they're in people's yards and they're in the neighborhood, and those are killing machines, right? And the only thing keeping them away from, you know, public areas was hunting.
Yeah.
And it's not like there was an unsustainable, like there's plenty of grizzly bears in BC, right? But it's hard because people get upset, right? They go like, well, that's just trophy hunting and that's just, and I get it. I get the emotions, and I'm not expecting everybody to be on board with this, but to at least take the time to understand both sides and not just go, that's a pretty animal, save it.
Yeah.
Right. No, like, okay, but you live in Edmonton where there's no grizzly bears versus the person who lives in Prince George or wherever, where there's grizzly bears in their backyard where their children are trying to swing on the play set. It's like, that's a totally different conversation.
Oh, big time. We've got it in Alberta.
Yeah.
We've got grizzly bears now where historically, in recent history, there were no grizzly bears.
Yeah.
Grizzly bears were a plains animal for the most part. And then, you know, the pioneer movement and all the rest of it pushed them into the mountains. But they were a plains animal. And so now there's grizzly bears back out on the plains.
Yeah. And it's a good thing. That's a good thing. But we also don't want...
To a certain degree.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We also live on the landscape and we also want to protect ourselves and make sure, like, you want the grizzly bears back in their historical range. Absolutely you do. Yeah. Right? But you also need to have education and wisdom around them being there, right? Because that's it's a 600-pound muscle with teeth.
It's a carnivore.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You know, they eat vegetation too, but they are they're an apex predator, you know, and we're prey.
Yeah.
You know, we see it all over the province, especially up in the Northwest region. We've got grizzly bears like everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're right around the city of Grand Prairie. They're in the farming community. They're all over. I had a bit of a debate when the grizzly bear was in Calgary, maybe a year ago. And there was this grizzly bear in Calgary, and they're trying to catch this grizzly bear. And there was a thing on Global News had an article, and there was these people saying, we got to get rid of this grizzly bear. So I went on there. I don't do Facebook much, but
I'm sure this went well. I can already sense.
So I went on there and I said, leave the grizzly bear alone. Mm-hmm. The grizzly bear is just doing what grizzly bears do. Mm-hmm. Grizzly bears were there way before Calgary was there.
Yeah.
That's their home. Mm-hmm. You guys need to learn to live with the grizzly bear in Calgary.
Yeah.
Well, holy cow, I just got ripped. And then I went back on there and I said, well, that's what you people from Calgary are telling us to do in northwestern Alberta, is to co-inhabitate with the grizzly bear. They were there first. You know, you got to leave them alone. You got to learn to live with them and all that stuff. But when it's in your backyard, your opinion changes.
Big time. And that's the hard part, right?
And that's the hard part. They just don't realize that.
Yeah. And not that I don't know enough about grizzly bear populations in Alberta, although I have a woman who's trying to come on it to speak to it, and they're not at a level that we want to start hunting them or anything like that.
But, actually, we've had presentations made at these stakeholder meetings.
Oh yeah.
And they've got, within 2 years, they'll pretty much have the province inventoried. Mm. And there's three levels. There's a stable bear population, an increasing, and a decreasing. Mm-hmm. And they've got pretty good information to show where bear populations are increasing, mm-hmm. where they're stable, where we need to do more to get them back up to kind of an acceptable level, I guess.
Yeah. But sustainable level, I guess, is a good way to put it, yeah.
So some of these areas where we've got enough grizzly bears now, they're lots of human interactions, mm-hmm. negative, mm-hmm. Livestock depredation, all kinds of stuff. We could sustain a hunt easily, but the social acceptance isn't there.
Yeah.
And now that BC did what they did based entirely on emotion and not science.
And they've said that. The minister as much as said so, right? Like he said it has nothing to do with science. This has to do with public outcry.
And like social acceptance.
Yeah.
So the voting public that have no real experience with bears, mm-hmm. or interactions with bears, they live in an apartment building in downtown Vancouver, but they just don't like somebody shooting a bear.
Yeah.
So a whole bunch of them vote and they get a government in that's wants to stay in power, and so we'll close the grizzly bear hunt.
Yeah.
And those people that have to deal with those bears in their backyards or get attacked by them, or you guys are on your own.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because democracy is the best way we know to figure this thing out, and that's a part of it, right? But it's and I don't know enough about it to really speak educatedly about it, but I know that of what I've heard, and it's just it comes down to not in my backyard thing, right? Like it's just
Yeah. So, and that's the trouble. Mm-hmm. Right across, I guess the world, the power of the vote, a lot of it comes from people who aren't really connected with that issue.
Yeah.
And yet, the politicians swing in the wind pretty easy from mm-hmm. left to right.
Well, it's easy to paint hunters as the bad guy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Just watch Bambi.
Yeah.
But and that's the one thing I think people misconstrue too, is that they think that these greedy hunters want to start hunting these animals, that's messed up, we just got them back mm-hmm. to sustainable levels. And it's like, no, you don't understand. To be able to hunt these animals means that's a success story. That means that we've brought them from the brink of something horrible, from extinction or whatever it was, up to a sustainable level. Now, not only to a sustainable level, because if they were only at a sustainable level, we wouldn't be hunting them.
Yeah.
They're at an overpopulated level where it's having negative impacts on society and the rest of the habitat and stuff like that. And there's an excess, exactly.
Yeah, there's a surplus.
And so we're removing that surplus, right? And it's whether it's elk or sheep or bear or whatever, that's just the truth of it. And people should be seeing, at least in my opinion, being able to hunt an animal again as a success story and go, yes, we did it. We're good.
Yeah. Oh, right? For sure.
Instead of demonizing it and seeing it as a problem. Because the other option is now you have to start, the taxpayers have to start spending money. Instead of earning money for having those animals removed, you have to start spending money and pay people to remove those animals. And then they won't be used to the extent that hunters would use them. They won't be appreciated the way a hunter would appreciate it. You know what I mean? Like even indigenous communities have the same argument, right? Like they want to be able to use the entire animal and appreciate it and incorporate it into their culture and utilize it, right? Yeah. So it's, we're getting into the weeds of the politics.
Yeah. and the problem is it's just gotten to be, I don't know, it's a rough time for wildlife managers because if they could manage the wildlife
using science, using just the science, it would be perfect. But yeah.
But then they get the political end of it in because of all the social, you know, just the social pressure.
It's a good check, though. I would argue that it's probably a good check to have those people saying what they want, right? Because, again, it forces you to nail down your argument and to really, really fully understand.
Or to fully defend what you plan to do.
Yeah. And then if there are any holes in the argument, you suss them out and you go, okay, now we have to rethink this. And that's it's ultimately, it's a good thing to be constantly establishing whether or not your argument is
Just on confirming the side of science, that, right? What you're saying is right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that those people are out there, but I agree. It does. I can't imagine being in the position of a wildlife manager to try and make those decisions and defend them to the uneducated public, right? It's tough, but
And I've had arguments with people too. I had an argument with a guy in Vancouver. He was with Bear Watch in Vancouver. And I don't even know how it all come about, but I phoned him anyway. And I talked to him on the phone. And I said, you know, you and your group don't want people like me hunting bears.
Yeah.
And I said, why?
Yeah.
Well, you know, bears are this and bears are that, and we don't think they should be killed and all that. I said, okay. Well, I hunt bears. I like hunting bears. Mm-hmm. They're an extremely interesting animal. Mm-hmm. You learn a lot from bears. They're fun to watch. They're good to eat. Mm-hmm. And I've got bear mitts. And, you know, I utilize the bear. I'm a consumptive user. Yeah. You're a non-consumptive user.
Yeah.
And so we talked a lot about that. And then, I said, the trouble I have with some of this stuff is you have perceptions of what I do that are wrong. Mm-hmm. And, but you aren't opening up to listen to my arguments, to maybe change your perception because you're unwilling to change.
That's a huge thing. That's everywhere, right? Oh, just that emotional stand your ground, not having a conversation, you're in the echo chamber, right? You're yelling and not listening, right? And that comes from every side of the political spectrum, right? Just people that are standing their ground and they believe in what they believe in and they don't. That's why I like this, like what you were saying about having the user group meetings that you guys have, right? Where you have all the stakeholders involved and you guys can have rational discussions and get to the solution together.
Yeah.
Rather than standing on your side of the picket fence and just shouting insults at one another, exactly. Right? Like you're actually trying to work towards an actual solution that is beneficial to everybody and everyone can agree upon, right?
Yeah.
So it's... Yeah, no.
I told this guy, and we got talking, and I said, "You're a vegetarian," and he said, "Primarily, yeah." Mm-hmm. And I said, "So you have no problem pulling a carrot out of the ground by the hair, and it's a living thing. Mm-hmm. You'll pull that carrot out of the ground by his hair, and that carrot is screaming, but you can't hear it because it's got little hair fibers coming off its going out into the soil to get its nutrients." Mm-hmm. That is a living thing, and you just ripped it out of the ground, left half them little follicles in the ground,
the fibers,
right off, a living thing. And that thing is screaming, but we can't hear it screaming, but it's a living thing, and you pulled it out of the ground, it's screaming.
There's definitely screaming is a weird way to put it, right? Yeah. It's definitely a living creature. It definitely is alive and knows what stress is and knows what it means to, like, you know what I mean? Like it responds to stress and it.
Exactly.
So it's definitely a living thing. It's just not a living thing as we know it with a brain and a
emotions,
nervous system that has emotions and stuff. Right. But it's a weird argument. Like I get where vegetarians and vegans come from. They're coming from a place of wanting to be as ethical and moral as possible. And I support them in their decisions to do what they do. Yeah. I think it's great. Like, I think even for a health purposes,
I got no problem with it. Yeah. They just have to realize that they have a huge imprint on the landscape, maybe more than hunters do.
Yeah, and I have no idea. I've struggled with that argument for so long. I don't know.
Their vegetables come from somewhere, and you look at farming practices and all the other stuff, pesticides, herbicides, all kinds. There's a whole gamut of other.
Yeah.
This guy I talked to in Vancouver, I asked him, do you use toilet paper?
Yeah.
He said, well, yeah. And I said, where does that come from?
Yeah.
That come from a forest that a bear lived in.
Yeah.
That forest isn't there anymore, just so you can use toilet paper. And so what impact did you have on that bear, all the other wildlife? Mm-hmm. Way more than me harvesting the surplus and utilizing that animal. And then I asked him, have you ever killed anything? He said, oh, just mosquitoes. And I said, oh, my God. I said, what if the Mosquito Watch people heard you and said that you killed mosquitoes? Like, there's people that don't want you killing mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. Just like you don't want me killing a bear.
Yeah.
But you'll kill a mosquito. So I said...
We're all full of our internal biases, right?
Oh, big time.
Yeah, and all until, of us.
And actually, we had a good conversation. There was no yelling or carrying on. But I just wanted to point out to him, you've got a stance, but there's holes in your position.
And there's holes, and there's probably holes in ours, right? That you and I are both missing, right? Like we have internal biases that we're totally probably ignoring and not aware of.
Yeah.
And it's important to have these conversations for exactly that purpose, to suss those out and so you can deal with them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know I fully support the hunting process and it ties in perfectly to the conservation and environmental protection and everything, right? Yeah. It's part of that system.
Yeah.
And a lot of environmentalists, like you go online, there's a lot of environmental groups and stuff that they see hunting as the anti-environmental protection, right? Yeah. And where meanwhile it's doing more for environmental protection and conservation than those groups are.
It's
by being involved and interactive and incorporating your life into nature rather than just saying like, I love it and I want it around.
Yeah.
Now you're actually a part of it, interacting and stuff.
There's a big movement now, and it's happened probably in the last 5 years, and BC was a big example, and now, you know, you're hearing about, you know, urbanites around Calgary and the bigger cities.
Yeah.
And they're getting into this. They want to know, and it's younger people.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know where their food's coming from.
Yeah. Big time.
They want to be able to get their own food.
Yeah.
There's people, you know, you look at the Hunter Ed statistics.
And, yeah.
And a lot of people that they're taking hunter ed, they want to be able to go out and get their own meat and put their food on the table, know where it comes from, all of that stuff.
Well, even getting stuff from along those lines of getting your own meat, also people are also getting their own wild vegetables too,
mm-hmm.
right? Like they're going out and collecting all kinds of herbs and mushrooms and different things and rose hips and turning it into meals, right? Because like you were saying, people want, there's a desire for that organic, natural process in our lives, right? And it's only normal that we want to be tied into our food. It's only in the last, 100 years, maybe not even that long, 50 years that we've been disconnected from that system, right? And it creates these, at least in my opinion, it creates these weird values that are so disconnected from the source. It's hard to rationalize.
Because you look back, you know, even 50 years ago, farmers raised, you know, pigs, chickens, cattle.
Mm-hmm.
They produced wheat and everything else, and they consumed all of that in-house.
Yeah.
And then if there was surplus, they'd maybe take it to town or sell it to somebody. Well, now we've gone to that guy produces cattle for all of us.
Yeah.
And those guys produce chickens for all of us and eggs and all of that. So back in the day, even when we were growing up, like, you know, you traded a pig for a cow for this guy.
And
so you had that connection. Now a lot of that is gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's
there's even a drive for people to want more sustainable farming practices too, right? Like more, in quotes, ethical, sustainable, natural farming practices. I think there's a drive. I think our food prices probably are going to go up just because people want that natural aspect and more ethical slaughter and more all that kind of stuff.
Well, you look at buying an organic banana and other than that other banana.
Yeah.
It's twice, but how do you prove that thing is really organic?
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
You know, it's all that. But
no, there's definitely a drive, a societal drive to want to be connected to that, right? Which I love.
Yeah.
It's awesome because it gets people asking questions.
And it brings them closer to what we do.
Totally.
This is what we've always done.
Yeah. And not everyone's going to be able to hunt. Not everybody is going to want to hunt, and that's okay. Yeah. But just my argument is that people should understand it from as true a perspective as possible so that they don't have internal biases regarding you know, what hunting is, right? It's not this Bambi situation, right? Yeah. Like it's not evil people going out there trying to kill things for jollies. Like one thing I wanted you to go through, and I have my own way of explaining this, but just to try and point out what the importance of the hunt versus the kill, right? Mm-hmm. Like what the emotions that go through my mind from, you know, I'm hunting and then I see an animal and the approach and the setup and the waiting and then finally the shot mm-hmm. and the kill and the cleaning and everything, right? Yeah. So I wonder if you could quickly just go through kind of your own mindset, where your head's at, the emotions you're going through when you go through that situation, right? Because I mean, yeah, I wonder if you just do that for me, starting with the, like, you know, the hunting and the relaxing and the
Well, I'm so
it's a hard one, and it's I've never really heard anybody really explain it well, and I can I'll add my own tidbits in between of how I feel as well. But
so
there's a lot of emotions.
I guess there's degrees of hunters.
Yeah.
And I put myself maybe at the extreme side of being a hunter. Mm-hmm. And I've had conversations with other hunters. Yeah. And I think everybody, if you're a hockey player, there's different levels of hockey players.
Of course, yeah. There's levels to this thing, everything.
Doctors, everything. There's different levels. You're just not all the same.
Yeah.
I kind of put myself maybe more to the extreme.
Yeah.
When I go hunting, my goal is to kill something.
Of course.
I'm a hunter.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to put the meat in the freezer, all of those things.
At the end
so
of
when
the day,
I go
for sure.
out, so I, when I go hunting, I try and put everything, I guess, in sync to achieve that success.
Yeah.
And I've been at it long enough to know that that ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Like the levels of, you know, your chance of success is low. So I try to do everything in my power to achieve that success.
Increase that chance, yeah.
Yeah. So, but at the same time, that success doesn't diminish the whole process.
Yeah.
I've had days sitting in tree stands, dawn till dark, and I've had consecutive days and weeks of not even taking my bow off the hook.
Yeah.
But every one of those days has been a successful day in my mind.
Yeah.
There was a weasel. There was squirrels in the trees. There was birds. And there's that anticipation that at any minute something could come by.
Yeah.
And the same, you know, if you're spot and stalk. Everything is. So I try and get everything to do as much under my control to achieve success.
Yeah.
But at the same time, success isn't, you know, the, I guess it's the ultimate goal, but it doesn't define the whole process.
If you couldn't acquire meat, you probably wouldn't do it, right? Because
it'd be just like a person hiking.
Yeah.
If I planned to hike to the top of that mountain and I don't get there, I wasn't successful in that day.
There's some regret.
Plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I got halfway.
But you still enjoyed
it. And I enjoyed
your time.
This and I seen something and I did that. So it's kind of the same thing. It's just, so I, you know, and I always have taken a lot of interest or appreciation or for the little things.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down, take a picture of a spider web. Or I've sat and watched spiders work in a web.
I watched a chipmunk eat a mouse this year while I was hunting.
Yeah.
That was so messed up. I literally watched a chipmunk chase, catch, and eat a mouse. It was messed up. Yeah. I was like, I did not. The things I've you learn, right? I never would have thought that
I've watched squirrels raid bird nests and come out with a young bird.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
The things you know? That you learn is just.
Oh, yeah. And it, to me, at the end of the day, I don't think I've ever had a day out hunting where something didn't happen or that, God, that was neat.
Or surprised you, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not all cruel like a chipmunk eating a mouse. A lot of it's just you can watch animals.
Being animals.
Just being, you know, feeding their young or helping out each other or whatever, right? Yeah. Like there's a lot. It's all beautiful and just it's lovely to be out there, right?
Yeah. So I've always, you know, I've got a goal in mind, and that is to harvest something. Mm-hmm. I want to get meat.
Yeah.
Our ultimate goal.
Yeah.
Whether it's got smaller horns or bigger horns. Some days I've let stuff walk, and other days, you know, God, that thing is at 10 yards broadside, and sorry, buddy.
Yeah.
We're going home. He's coming home with me. So I always try and do as much in my power, under my control, to achieve that success of harvesting an animal.
Yeah.
And whether it's I'm looking for deer that day or moose or elk or...
Yeah.
And, you know, you're a hunter. You know, it don't happen like that.
No.
But so I that's what I try to do.
I've hunted 20 days this year, and I've had lots of interactions, but I wasn't able to acquire any meat, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's not abnormal, right?
Well, I remember one year... it's happened to me lots. I sat 23 days, well, more after, late afternoon evenings, 23 days, and I never seen an animal out of my tree.
Yeah.
And I'd move tree stands, and I'd do all those things, and nothing. And then the evening of the 24th day, this buck walked by, and I got him. Like, it was just, you know, so, yeah. I always try to do as much under my control to, because it's so difficult.
Well, and that's just right? There's so much anticipation around that one thing. You spend 23 days trying to achieve an accomplishment. There's not many other tasks that you can do that would, you know what I mean? That someone
require
would
require that input.
Yeah. It would require you to go 23 days, quote unquote, unsuccessful without any luck.
Yeah.
And then the 24th day, finally, you've persevered so long that you finally, you know, succeeded. But there's something primal about it, really. Like, it's just, it turns a switch in your brain where you're just like, and I think the amazing thing is the more consecutive days I've been away from society, away from my phone, away from whatever, the more things I hear. And the more things I pick up on, and the more things I notice, you become more,
things down. You appreciate what the little thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, big time.
It's wild.
Yeah. So I try to, every time I go out, I'm going out with a purpose. Mm-hmm. And 99 times out of 100, I don't achieve that.
Yeah.
But every time I go out, it's successful in some way.
Yeah.
And then, so like the chapters of a book, there's all the preparation, there's the practice, there's getting the gear together, there's the scouting, there's, you know, putting up cameras and walking the bush and figuring things out. And then, you know, sitting for hours and hours. And sometimes it only takes an hour.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just takes days and weeks. And then all of a sudden, there's, I guess, a target animal, you know, one you have a tag for. One that's, you know, a buck and not a doe, or it's a bigger buck that you want, you know, you let a few young guys walk.
Yeah.
Try to get an older one. You know, if the freezer's kind of full, you get a little more selective and that kind of thing. So, Jesus, here he is. And the beauty about bow hunting is he's there. Like, you can see his wet nose. You can see his eyelashes blinking.
Yeah.
You know, they scratch their ear, all those things that, to me, it's just, you're in their world.
You are, totally.
And, you know, and it's a different experience, way different than people that have hunted with a rifle for years, like my trapline partner. And I've got some good friends that are wildlife photographers, but they've got the 2000 millimeter lens that can suck them right up.
Yeah.
Well, if you get within 10 yards of that animal and they don't know you're there, it's a special feeling. To me, it's a very special feeling.
Absolutely.
You know? And then I've had back spasms when there's an animal that's the one that I'm going to try and harvest.
Yeah.
And he's there or she's there.
Yeah.
I get more worked up over doe mule deer than anything I've probably hunted.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about them. Those are by far... they're way harder to hunt than bucks.
Really?
Because especially in the rut, the bucks are thinking about fighting and love.
Yeah.
And the does never quit thinking about survival.
Yeah.
And they're switched on all the time.
Yeah.
And when we had lots of mule deer and, you know, we'd draw doe tags and we'd hunt them with the bow for, one, they're excellent eating. Mm-hmm. They're hard to get. And you got to try and figure out a dry doe out of all the rest of the does.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're good eating and all the rest, and good practice.
Yeah.
You know, when that another critter comes in, you know, you shoot several does, you're calmer because you've done it. And so anyway, yeah, I've had back spasms.
That's how
when that animal, yeah. I just get so excited and
trying to keep true to all the practice you've done during that excitement and that adrenaline.
Yeah, and they got to be turned a certain way and a certain this way and a certain that.
Yeah. And then everything has to line up.
Oh, you know, and then you get the shot and it takes off and it falls down. And
yeah.
And God, and there's just, you know, that's, you know, the second last chapter.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had some pretty emotional days where I've harvested an animal.
Yeah.
You know, you get teared up.
Yeah.
You know, I pay respect to them, mm-hmm. you know, and I know lots of other guys do too in certain ways.
I do too. Absolutely.
You know,
it's not just, and that's what I wanted, exactly what I wanted to get, right? Was that it's not just, I got the meat. Nice. Yes. Fist pump, right? There's remorse. There really is remorse. And there's
a life.
Yeah. You took a life and there's real understanding and you're, I think what makes it such an incredible experience is that it isn't just elation and happiness. It's the sense of accomplishment with a severe sense of remorse and, oh my God, what have I just done?
Yeah.
And it's because you definitely recognize that you've just ended a life. You know what I mean? And you've turned this into food.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the complex matrix of emotions going on there is impossible to explain to somebody unless they've experienced it.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what I wanted to get, was that there's all this buildup and anxiety around being out there and wanting something to go right and wanting to be successful. Mm-hmm. And then when you do finally get that animal and you can tell that this is going to work, this animal is going to do what you need it to do in order for you to be successful. And the heart beat faster, right? And then some people start to shake or you start to whatever, right? Yeah. And you start to get excited. And then as soon as that arrow is loose or that bullet is loose and you know that it's gone true and you haven't wounded it or anything and everything's gone right and you see that animal go down after a couple seconds, there's that, it's like, it's an amplified feeling of adrenaline and at the same time, an absolute just plummet of just, oh damn.
Yeah.
The consequences become real, right? And it's just, I don't know how to explain it to people because it's not just both ends of the spectrum at the exact same time. Yeah. And it has such an impact such a real impact. It's reality, right? There's no escaping what you've just done.
No, for sure.
It's just, it's an incredible feeling.
Yeah.
And I think it makes you a better person. I really do. It makes you more thoughtful.
It does. It absolutely, because you have a real, hunters have a connection with life and death. We're living, we're going to die. Everybody's, you know, alive, but they're going to be dead sooner or later. But hunters have a connection with life and death because we live it. We see life and we take life. And some people, I don't know, they can't accept that, but we take life and we cause death. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of different emotions that go with that.
Big time.
And I think hunters are so much more connected with that than just, you know, Joe Public.
And more thoughtful because of it, right?
Oh, big time.
More thoughtful and more compassionate.
And not everybody is. You see guys that are bloodlust and all that other. But that's such a small sliver.
It is. Unfortunately, it's the loudest sliver sometimes.
And that's the one that gets the attention.
Yeah. Unfortunately, sometimes the grip and grin with blood on your hands is not tasteful and it's not respectful. And it just maybe just understand the way this is going to look to other people. right? Yeah. And yeah, of course, there are some people who are just assholes.
Oh.
And they're just out there. Like, there are people that just go out poaching and just looking for antlers and just looking for... Yeah. Those assholes exist, for sure. We're not trying to speak for those people, right? No. That's not... But that's a minority.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not a hunter.
That's not a hunter. That's
you know,
asshole.
And that's why, you know, people, you know, and we pay respect in a lot of ways, you know, we, you know, just pause and reflect, or, you know, I just kind of sit with the animal and, you know, just, I don't think I say anything specific or anything, but you just have that moment. And some guys do it different and, or people do it different, you know, and then, well, now there's the next chapter. You got to get the knife out. You know, you do all the processing. You haul the animal out. Whether you butcher it yourself on your kitchen table or and wrap it yourself, or you take it somewhere and get it done. And then that's another chapter. And then the next one is some of us, you know, get the hide tanned, or we make mitts out of the hide, or we get it mounted, whether it's just a set of horns or if it's the animal or a life size or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's not bragging about something, because bragging to me is a little bit, I don't know, it doesn't seem quite right. But to me, it's all
it's not an ego thing. It's not really an ego thing. It's
not for most people. Some people, it is.
Yep.
Some people go, "Jesus, look at this." And you know, but you can tell them, people, it doesn't matter if it's a deer head on the wall or if it was a car in the driveway.
Yeah.
People, there's a certain element of people that have that ego. And, but for the most part, and I know a lot of guys that have mounts and stuff, and it's not, some of them are quote unquote big or special in a certain way, but most of it is just to pay homage to that animal, to respect. That's part of the paying respect to me. You know, you look at that animal, and I've got quite a few things, and you know, I'll go downstairs, and some days I'll just go down there and sit, and I'll look at that thing, and I'll go through the whole, God, you know, I had to move that tree stand 3 times, and I sat so many days, and I did this, and I did, and
you remember things, and you re-experience the whole thing, and you, yeah. It's hard to convince people that.
And that salami was awesome.
Yeah,
like all of that stuff.
Yeah,
and absolutely. To me, it's a level of respect.
Yeah, totally. You know, utilizing that whole animal, right? Yeah. Like
You know, so yeah, so I think, and that's what we have to try. I think as hunters and consumptive users, we have to get the message across a little more.
It's, yeah,
like I said before, it's my culture. It's my tradition. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it's a legacy that I've passed on, which, you know, has kind of happened. And then it's about paying respect. And just because I have something mounted and put on the wall, it's not an ego thing, and it's not, you know, it's a trophy. Well, a trophy is a trophy in the eye of the beholder. It doesn't matter what it is. And it's just paying respect, and it's all part of the process. You know, and at the end of the day, you know, we're there to ensure basically that this wildlife is going to be around. And I can't hunt moose every year like I used to because of a draw. Well, that's just the way it is to keep moose on the landscape.
So
it's, you know, some people, they, when you start to explain to them, you know, they kind of don't hunt, or, and they've got certain values. And I've had a couple of people actually that I've taken out, and they've seen the harvest, and they've kind of seen, I don't know how I do things, and they've actually come around. Actually, one hunts now, and you know, when they got their first animal, it was a whitetail with a bull, and they just, now they get it.
Yeah,
they get it. Yeah. They get that connection now, and the excitement and everything, and then getting their hands bloody and having the, this is mine. And geez, we had steak the other night. Oh, it was so good. And
it's always on your mind.
Yeah.
It's always on your mind. My wife gets upset with me, 'cause it's just, it's all I talk about.
Well, I'm lucky too, 'cause my wife hunts and, you know, and, you know, the son does, and his wife and son-in-laws, and so we're all kind of connected with it. So I don't have to, you know, battle it too hard.
Not that I'm battling it at all, but it's just funny because we'll be sitting down for a Christmas dinner or something like that, right? And her and my father-in-law, or me and my father-in-law are talking about hunting, right? And she's like, can you guys just like enjoy Christmas? Like, let's do Christmas right now, right? It's like, you know what I mean? We're here. Let's do this part. And they're just like, sorry. Yeah, you're right. I'm getting.
And then especially, you know, involved in like the ABA and stuff. It's 24/7 every day of the year.
Yeah. No, it's awesome.
You know, so, but yeah, it, I don't know where it's all going to go. You know, this social influence on politicians is kind of scary.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think personally, I take the stance that I think the internet was a good thing. I think all the bullshit that we see coming from there, I think it does more interconnectedness and connecting certain people in a good way that are trying to achieve something good for society. I think it's ultimately a good thing. Although there is a lot of, you know.
Yeah, negative and, yeah.
There's a lot of that. Yeah. But you can choose to focus on that or choose to not, right? So
it's a vehicle to get our word out.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, as much as the other side gets their word out, well, at least we've got that same vehicle. It's just if we take to choose it. And that's one of the things I have struggled with for years and years is to get people involved. Mm. And it doesn't take much.
No.
You know, one letter to your MLA. Because I have friends and family that work for government, and when a letter from an MLA comes down the pipe, it hits your desk. You stop everything. You could be working on something that'll save the world tomorrow, and you get a letter from a concerned constituent from an MLA.
Yeah.
Everything stops.
Yeah.
And they deal with that one letter.
Yeah.
And I've personally, outside of my, you know, Alberta Bull Hunters president position. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in an issue right now where I wrote my MLA.
Yeah.
And one letter followed up with another letter, mm-hmm. not accepting the first response.
Yeah.
Wasn't good enough. Followed up with another letter. And now the minister took my concerns to another minister who formed a committee, and they're dealing with my concerns.
That's good.
And I'm still dealing with it. And the government works slow, but and it's so frustrating to tell, you know, to try and get people to write a letter to your MLA. Like that's the quickest way to get results. Don't come to me and want the ABA to do something.
You do something.
Because we can write a letter.
Yeah.
But your letter is 10 times more powerful than a letter from the Alberta Bull Hunters.
Yeah, because they know what they're getting from them. But from
exactly. And this constituent votes. The Alberta Bull Hunters don't vote.
Yeah.
And if we could get 10 of you guys to write a letter, oh, God, the power, it's incredible.
Yeah.
But they'll sit around a beer, have a coffee over lunch, and they'll pound that drum for hours.
Yeah.
Get them to write, sit down. I did a piece in my president's report, and I spoke about it at the banquet. That letter took me 4 minutes out of my day to write that letter. And yet guys will sit in a bar for hours and talk about the same thing, and it just does nothing.
Yeah,
it gets your blood pressure up, and
you
might get a hangover, and that's the answer.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's important to speak your mind when it comes to those kind of issues, for sure, and not use your vote, but also, I've never done that, I can say, but it's important that people do, for sure, especially if it's something they believe in so strongly, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just the power of one letter. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. And people just, oh no, like, geez.
Couldn't do that.
It does.
God, you know. That's what people think. They think that it gets lost in the fray, but it sounds like it doesn't. So that's good.
Yeah. You know, so just the power of one letter.
Yeah.
Just write your MLA.
It's awesome. You have any kind of final thoughts you want to leave people with? I mean, we've really done the conversation justice here. I think we've gone through a lot, but if you had any final things that you wanted to finish off before we end this thing.
Yeah, thoughts? Not really. I think we covered it pretty good.
We did a pretty good job.
kind of get to the meat and potatoes of a lot of things, you know?
And there's so much more to conversation to be had, but for the sake of a podcast, I think we better shut her down.
Sure. Sounds good.
I don't want to have a 3-hour podcast. I think people might cut out pretty early. Thanks a lot for coming on, man. This was an awesome conversation. Yeah. This is exactly what I was hoping to get out of this, was a really detailed, thoughtful, well thought out discussion around hunting and why people should care, right? Yeah. Like this was great. I appreciate you coming on. And
yeah, no problem. Anytime. I guess
if people want to get become a part of the ABA, right? Like you guys have a membership and you guys stand up for hunters' rights and,
yeah,
and
all kinds of things. We have an annual banquet, an awesome newsletter, quarterly newsletter, insurance program, awards program, 3D archery. Try to get the youth involved as much as we can, you know, with different things. One of the things we're kind of I shouldn't let the cat out of the bag, but there's going to be some senior recognition at our banquet this year.
Nice.
From
okay.
senior bull hunters that are in their 80s and 70s. And,
nice.
And, yeah. And, you know, we focus on the youth and all that other stuff. Well, there's another spectrum there that we should be inspired by and motivated by. So we're going to do some of that this year.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And that's the Alberta Bowhunters Association.com.ca.
www.bowhunters.ca.
Oh, just bowhunters.ca. That's it. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And if they Google Alberta Bowhunters, it'll come up.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, this is awesome. And I think people are going to love this.
Yeah. This will be good. Glad to help out.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.